I'm Taylor Stafford, and this is Talk Taboo.
Yeah! Come on over!
We ask a lot of people if they like their asshole touch.
We really are breaking down stigmas. It's everything sex.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Talk Taboo. We have such a freaking awesome episode today. I want to apologize for the audio connectivity on this guy. I did this podcast with Annalisa. She was also on one of the old podcasts where we talked about anal sex and vibrators and all of that good stuff. Well, that sexual lady over there is also, has been in the syringe exchange for years now. I think it's been years at multiple syringe exchanges. She is living in Reno. I am in Seattle. And so we had to do a voice call for it. And sometimes it's kind of hard to hear her. I tried my best to really change the audio. I'm also not techie at all. Just out here doing my best on this thing called a podcast I have. So you might have to turn up your volume a little bit when she's speaking, but she has some freaking awesome information about syringe exchanges, and I call them needle exchanges because that's what I originally had called them. It's the same thing. But syringe exchanges are something that is very controversial. It's found itself to be very political in the fact that some people think that we are enabling drug use by it. Some people think that we are reducing the stigma in offering health services and reducing the physical disorders and diseases that we get from it. But just to explain a syringe exchange, Annalisa also does a really great job at explaining it in here. We also talk about different kinds of overdoses and how they reverse it, and how they also are really great in offering sex services as well as sex testing, condom, birth control, things like that. But really, syringe exchanges were made to reduce hepatitis, HIV, and any other kind of needle exchange illnesses on people that are IV drug users. It was not to reduce how many people that were doing drugs. It was to reduce how many people are actually getting life-threatening illnesses from using the drugs. So basically, they give you clean needles, they give you free services in order to do it correctly to reduce carditis, which is an infection in your heart, which a lot of people that participate in IV drug users get, as well as hepatitis, HIV, things like that. She does such a good job. If any of you guys have any other questions after listening to this, please send me an email at womenagainsttaboo@yahoo.com. You can also go onto my Instagram at @IamTaylorStafford. Shoot me a quick question, or you can go to womenagainsttaboo.org under the Talk Taboo Education tab, and then there's anonymous questions. I will be answering the questions with Annalisa. If you guys have any, I will either text them back to you, email back to you, or answer them on the podcast. But other than that, I hope you enjoy this podcast. It has such good information. One of my favorite episodes. So enjoy and let us know how you liked it. All right. Welcome, Annalisa, to the podcast again.
Hello.
We're not talking about as fun of a topic this time. Vibrators are
fun.
True, but vibrators are very, very, very exciting.
Hey, I mean, so are needles.
So are needles.
Like needles and condoms and like sexual things go hand in hand.
Go hand in hand. That is true. So you worked for a needle exchange in Portland. Correct.
Yeah, so I started working at the needle exchange in Reno, Nevada. And then I started working at one in Portland. So basically I work for a primary care clinic that works with homeless and low-income individuals. And so we, as an organization, focus on harm reduction practices, which basically, I mean, harm reduction practices is exactly what it sounds like. Basically reducing harm to technically harmful activities. So, I mean, those are included in, like, drug use and sexual activities, you know.
Oh, I didn't realize you guys did sexual activities, too. I thought it was just needles.
Yeah, so, I mean, so the way, actually, that needle exchange has got started, so, I mean, they started in Europe, but the way they got started in North America was actually in Canada, in Vancouver. That was the first needle exchange, and it got started because of the HIV/AIDS epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
When that was going strong, a lot of it was being transmitted through sharing needles.
Right.
So that's how it got started, and then the first one actually opened in Washington in North America.
In Seattle?
Right. I don't think it was Seattle. I can't remember right now. I don't think it was Seattle, though.
Ooh, I'll have to look.
Yeah. And I think Portland was the second one. The one that I work at, I believe, was the second one to ever open. And then I think it was San Francisco and then New York. And then they kind of just kept popping up. But basically what they showed is that when you have a syringe exchange, HIV rates went down, and as well as Hep C. And then also more people had access to treatment or wanting, like, basically the way that a harm reduction thing is supposed to work is it's supposed to be very non-judgmental. And so, mm-hmm. like, at our organization, we provide naloxone, which reverses an opioid overdose. Mm-hmm. And then I think eventually what a lot of people find is the more times they overdose, the less likely they want to keep using. And so they will be...
Oh, really? That's an interesting fact. Okay.
So they'll be more inclined to seek out treatment. So my position at the syringe exchange was I was working with medication-assisted treatment. So I was working with Suboxone. And if someone at the syringe exchange asked about Suboxone, so, I mean, and we consider medication-assisted treatment to be harm reduction. A lot of people think it's like treating one addiction for another, but I really don't think that that's true. And I can definitely even attest that just seeing people, I mean, if you met someone that was using methadone or Suboxone or Subutex or Vivitrol or any of the medication-assisted treatment,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're holding down a job and they have a family, you would never know that they were taking that. But then you obviously are pretty aware of someone that is using heroin every day.
So that's
a large difference.
Interesting. So you said that you don't think it's not doing one addiction for the other.
Yeah, so a lot of people think that it's treating one addiction for another. I mean,
because you're replacing the drug with Suboxone, correct?
No, so, I mean, so the way Suboxone works, so you can definitely, if you're on methadone, you can still use heroin, or if you are taking Subutex, you can still use heroin, or any other opiate, so, you know, Oxycontin, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Suboxone is buprenorphine naloxone, so the naloxone in it, if you use heroin or you use an opioid, it actually will put you into precipitated withdrawal because your body always has naloxone in it. So the second you use an opioid, it takes it off of your receptors and makes you sick, puts you right into withdrawal, which is the same thing that like Narcan does.
So this
Narcan is naloxone.
So because people are taking these things long-term now, right?
Right.
And so that's the... I guess the contraindication behind it is people are like, well, for me, it's like some of these drugs were meant to reverse an opioid crisis when they're actually overdosing or when they're actually in crisis. But now we're taking them every day long term in order to, like, in case they take an opioid. Is that right?
No. Okay. So.
Sorry. I'm like not following.
No, I will do a much better job of explaining it. Okay, so basically, we're talking medication-assisted treatment, which is different than naloxone Narcan. Naloxone Narcan is what you give someone when they're overdosing.
Right, okay.
So Suboxone is the only medication-assisted treatment that has naloxone in it.
Oh, okay.
But there are other forms of, and I'm not going to keep saying medication-assisted treatment, I'll just say MAT, because that's...
Yeah.
So there are other forms of MAT, like methadone and Vivitrol and Subutex, and all of those don't have naloxone in it. So you can take those and still use opiates. But basically what medication-assisted treatment is for is to wean yourself off of heroin, okay. And then it is there for your cravings and your triggers. So you are constantly...
I see. So that's the benefit. Okay.
Right. So you're taking a pill every day, and I think the basis is you're not supposed to be getting high because you're being prescribed such a low dose. I know Oregon, the highest they prescribe Suboxone is 24 milligrams, and mm-hmm. I think with methadone you can go pretty high up. I definitely think methadone makes you high, but then again, I mean, how harm reduction do you want to be? So you're taking methadone, which is something that is made in a lab, and it's safe, and it's not laced with fentanyl, and you're getting it, and it's daily dispense to you. So, I mean, if you are waking up every morning and taking your methadone, I think, you know, that is being harm reduction, and you're not going to overdose on fentanyl. And for the most part, we'll still be able to hold down a job and X, Y, and Z.
Right. Okay. So that's where the harm reduction comes in. I didn't realize that was the reason that people were taking the medication. Have you seen Seattle is Dying, that documentary?
I have not, no.
Okay, well, it kind of talks about that, and the biggest bit of critique that I thought of when I saw that was that they were kind of making the end of it like a drug infomercial about, like, Suboxone and methadone and all these things, and it kind of sounded like it was like a big pharma kind of push to take these medications because big pharma put opioids so, like, sporadically on the market, and so many people were taking opioids. Now there's a lot of people involved with that, right? Like doctors, physicians, nurses, like everybody in the whole industry went involved with people getting addicted to those things. And now it's like they're doing, here's some new medication that gets you off of the drug. And that just could honestly be a conspiracy theory, but I just thought it was kind of interesting.
I just read this book called American Overdose. I think it's by Chris McGrail, I want to say.
Ooh, I'll have to read it.
And it's start to finish of how we got to be in this opioid epidemic. Definitely brought on by pharmaceutical companies. You know, right. The research behind all of these opioids that were being pushed was basically, I think it was like a 9-person cancer study about how they were addicted because they were administering these opioids in a hospital setting and then therefore said, they're not addictive and marketed them like crazy. And that was also before we had so much regulation how much can be prescribed, what they can be prescribed for. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies, and I know you're a nurse, you know about the fifth vital sign, which is pain.
Right.
Like, the pharmaceutical companies put that into hospitals as a way.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Prescribe opioids. Yeah. So, It's really, really crazy. It's definitely a book that you're like, oh, shit, like, and I mean, you want to go as far to say, like, you know, doctors didn't know the extent of it, but then there was also, I mean, yeah, there are a lot of doctors that didn't know the extent of what these opioids did, but then there were also so many doctors that were then making so much money off of it that they were like, I don't care if people are getting addicted because I'm making an extra $250,000 a year or whatever, you know. So I think the difference is now they're so regulated. I mean, Suboxone is a controlled substance, so we have to check the prescription monitoring program every time we would prescribe it. There's a max dose. So in Oregon, the max dose is 24 milligrams a day. And with Suboxone, you can't really get addicted because of the naloxone. There's a cap on it.
Oh.
I mean, you know, you can say it's like training, maybe pharmaceutical companies are now trying to prescribe something different, but the, like, the way they're allowed to prescribe now and as much as they're allowed to prescribe is so much different that I think that it is helping the opioid epidemic. Mm-hmm. I think 2018 was the first year that the overdose rate actually decreased. Yeah, from prescription medication. So, of course, we're still seeing overdose rates of fentanyl, but I think that those are in places where you can't easily get naloxone or Narcan. I don't know. In Oregon, we say Narcan, but the, you know, that's just the brand name of it. But it's naloxone.
Yeah. So when someone comes into your facility, what does that process look like?
So my time was mainly spent in the clinic, but in the syringe exchange, I think is what you meant.
Yeah.
So basically they come in, it's a little, most of the time there's a line and you go in. Actually, Multnomah County, so Portland, is seeing a raise in HIV right now, which is, it's among meth users, and it's meth injection drug users that also, I think it's more pertaining to their sexual activities and not necessarily injection drug use, but that's kind of, I think they go hand in hand. So we used to be a one-for-one exchange, so every needle you brought in, we would match you up to 100 in a day. If you brought in more than 100 syringes, you would then have like a bank account and you could access more the following day. But because of this rise in incidence in HIV, we then changed the cap. So you could take out as many as you brought in. So, I mean, I had one person bring in like 3,000 syringes in one day.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And I mean, and you all, like, this is also someone that comes to the syringe exchange once a year. So
different
places. And then they just return it all at once.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, no one can use 3,000 syringes in, like, a short period of time.
Well, they could also be collecting them from the streets, right?
Exactly. And that's what a lot of people do. They either collect them, or, you know, they hand them out to their friends. So, so you basically walk in, you give us, we ask for only a few demographic questions, and then we set you up with a pseudonymous code, which is the first two letters of your first name. So mine would be A-N, the first two letters of your mom's first name, so mine would be E-L, and then the month and year you were born, because if you are younger than 18, you cannot access our services, unfortunately.
Okay, so it's 18 and over.
It's all right, 18 and over, okay. But I think that's a little silly, because there are definitely people that are younger than 18 that are, you know, injecting substances.
Yeah, tons of kiddos on my unit could really, really, really benefit from that.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think it's kind of the response, and I always tell this to my parents because they were confused about, like, a syringe exchange, and they're like, oh, I feel like it's enabling people's behaviors.
Yeah, I hear that a lot.
Yeah, and I mean, and so I say, you know, no one's just going to wake up and be like, oh, there's a syringe exchange. I think I'm going to inject drugs today, you know?
Yeah, let's try it out.
Like, I, my paper for undergrad, for my thesis was about, you know, drug addiction is related to, like, adverse childhood experiences or trauma. So, right. And it's a coping mechanism, which, I mean, a lot of people say it's a negative coping mechanism, but I try and be positive about, you know, if you're homeless and you are taking meth to stay up so you aren't getting raped at night, then I think that is then an effective coping mechanism. Or you're doing meth or heroin because it's freezing cold outside and you have to sleep outside because the shelters are at capacity, then I think you're doing what you need to do to get by.
Right. I guess I've never actually heard of that kind of reason why that people are doing drugs. I think we always assume that, well, everyone has their different opinions, right, on why they assume people are doing drugs. But I think that a lot of people either assume that they're doing drugs because they're just in with the bad crowd, or even people like me in the healthcare field, I always go to the fact that they don't have any kind of connection and they're just using it simply as a coping skill because their brain is missing something and it's helping them to survive mentally so that they don't do the alternative, which is take their own lives. So I guess it's interesting that you were like, there's maybe other reasons that people are using drugs, like taking meth so that they don't get raped. Like, that's really interesting.
Right. I mean, I definitely have had a lot of patients at the clinic that have been, you know, they grew up around drugs. Their parents were doing drugs. Their parents were giving them drugs. They have been homeless their whole life. So it's like, so how do we ask someone that's been homeless their whole life to then make these positive choices when they've never, you know, learned a positive attachment theory, or they, you know, we're just asking so much. It's like, how do you give someone this plate and then try and ask for different outcomes?
Well, I think when you say that, you know, people that have been homeless their whole life, that's like, I put that on us as a system. Like, we are failing them. Because at one point, that adult was a homeless child. And the system didn't do anything about it because they must be still homeless, whether that being in crappy foster care systems or, you know, in and out of their parents' arms, never having a right place to stay, never getting the right treatment, never getting the right coping skills. That's a failure in the system.
Totally. I 100% agree. But then it's like, okay, well, where do we get these resources?
Right, for sure.
How do we build? I mean, so that's the thing. Like, homeless shelters, and I've heard this from so many of my patients, most females are like, I'd rather sleep on the streets than I would rather sleep in a homeless shelter.
I agree. Because I've heard that, too.
They don't feel safe, which, I mean, it makes total sense. And I also think, you know, something my supervisor always says is, most people that are homeless aren't homeless because they use drugs. They use drugs because they're homeless.
Thank you. Yes. And I think that people, so many people think it's the absolute opposite way.
Totally. Another really good book you should read is The New Jim Crow. And it talks about, I mean, that is like diving into racism, but even more so, you know, when you see a homeless person, you are afraid.
Yes.
But in reality, you are more likely to be attacked by a white male, and you probably know them, than you are to be attacked by a homeless person.
That's like so crazy, and I always think that, and I think that working in psych has really made me not as scared of people, but I think the reason why I'm not as scared is because I can read them and I can read their behaviors and their actions better, so I know if they are just high and are just going to keep them to themselves or if they are looking to harm. And I think that we're just not educated, but it's like, I think about that and like, how are we supposed to educate people if they're not actually around them? You can't just teach that in a book, in a classroom. You can't be like, oh, this is what human behavior is, and this is how to tell if someone's about to blow up on you, or you know, this is how to tell if they're violent. And you can teach that all you want, but until you actually interact with these people and really, really get a sense of what they're actually trying to teach you in these classes or whatever, is all the difference. Because I'm around these kids that are dangerous all the time, and I've been doing it for 7 months now, and I'm feeling more comfortable, but that's me doing it for 7 months. That's a long time. People don't have this much time to fit into their day to not be scared of people on the streets.
Definitely. And I mean, I think, you know, America is known as like being a cashless system, but I don't think that that's true at all, and I think homeless people are, you know, at the bottom of the cash system. You know, I work with homeless people all day, and I absolutely love it, and I've actually never met more kind people that are so, like, one, giving, but also so thankful. Like, you know, I have people come into the syringe exchange that literally have nothing, and we give them syringes, and then they want to, like, give us their food, and it's like, it's just funny, you know, like, I understand you, this is only you, and they're just doing that because they're actually so thankful, and kind.
They don't know how to thank you, besides, because they don't have much, and so they're trying to give you everything that they have because they're so appreciative.
Exactly. I know there's like a, and I'm like not religious at all, but I always think of this as like this biblical, whatever you want to call it, like I said, not religious, but it talks about how, like, these kings are, like, giving all of this gold into, like, this bucket, and then this, like, man who has nothing, like, gives, like, 10 cents or so, and, you know, it's like, oh, he gave all that he had. It was, like, more than, like, the kings who are giving, like, literally,
yeah,
you know, thousands of pieces of gold or whatever, which is exactly how I think of, like, the people I work with. And honestly, they're so amazing, and it makes me really sad that they get treated so poorly. I said hi to this homeless lady on my way to work. I said good morning to her, and she stopped me, and she was like, thank you. She was like, I don't know the last time someone has said good morning to me. And it, like, almost made me want to cry. She was so nice, you know?
Yeah. I listened to this TED Talk, and it was about this guy who almost blew up a school when he was younger. And it was about depression and whatever, and it kind of relates to this, because he was saying how, you know, I was going to go to school, and I had the gun on me, and I was like, as soon as someone pisses me off or is rude to me or bullies me, like, they're going down. And for some reason, that day, no one bullied him. And someone went up to him and was like, hey, like, just started having a normal conversation with him at school. I think he was in high school at the time. And he was like, that conversation of just talking to me like I was a human about something, like I mattered for 2 seconds, made all of the difference. And I think we forget that sometimes when homeless people are on the streets begging for money or for food or whatever. And it's so easy for us to turn a blind eye because it's uncomfortable, or we're like, well, you're going to just use my money for drugs or whatever.
Yeah.
But we forget that you can just be a nice human. You don't have to give them anything. You can just go up to them, roll down your window when you're going on the freeway, and be like, hey, how are you doing today? Like, just talking to them, saying good morning, things like this. And we just take them for granted, and we just think that those things aren't going to make a difference. But you don't have to give them their money, but you can give them your attention and give them a really kind word for the day, and that could be all that they need.
Totally. And I even always say, my old roommate went out in Portland, and this man asked us for money, and she gave him, like, you know, a couple dollars, maybe like $3, and we're walking away, and she was like, hopefully he doesn't buy drugs with that. And I was like, honestly, if he does, like, he's just, I mean, it's cold and he has to sleep outside, so, like, you know, that's what he needs right now to cope. And that doesn't necessarily mean that, I think, like, the reason that drugs have such a bad, like, connotation with them is because of the war on drugs. But then it's like, oh, okay, like, you are a white girl that occasionally does cocaine and, like, yeah, other forms of drugs, but that's okay. But this man who, you know, who we don't know his story, but let's say his parents did crack, and now he's doing crack because his mom was giving it to him when he was 12, and now we want him to not do drugs, and we don't want him to be living off of government money, but it's like, he's never known anything different. He's grown up in the system.
And we're not giving him a chance. We're just,
exactly.
You're just assuming that that's what he's going to do with it. And I think that so easily we just, there's a few bad people, right? Or a few people that are absolutely going to take that money and use it for drugs, right? Or absolutely going to do something terrible with it. But we forget about all of the people that aren't going to do that and that are really trying to get out. And we let those few people ruin it for everybody. And I think as humans, we're just so focused on the negative, and that we forget that you could actually be taking away help from someone who actually really, really needs it and is going to do something great with it. But, you know, you can say, oh, he's going to use my money for drugs. Well, you're not helping him in any other way, are you?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
I'm like, you can use my money for drugs. That's fine. Like, I'm probably going to take $10 later on and use it for drugs as well, but my drug is a different drug than yours is. So, I mean, I don't need people that are, like, so against people that use drugs, drink alcohol, or smoke weed, or, you know, do occasional cocaine. It's like, just because that drug is different than your drug doesn't mean that you can judge someone's drug.
Or even like any other coping skill, like whether you don't do drugs, we all use coping skills, and we all, pretty much every single one of us, has a shitty coping skill that we go to, whether that be excessively working out and spending so much money to these companies that are trying to change your body. Okay, well, that's where your money's going. That's you're like, okay, well, that's, you know, facilitating your eating disorder, but I'm not going to not pay you to pay these other companies.
Exactly.
Or I'm trying to think of, like, another coping skill that people always use. Or shopping, for example. Like, I'm paying you to work here, and you're going to go use it and blow it all on gambling or shopping or whatever. It's like, we all have our vices, and I think we are so easy to judge other people when they're living a life that we don't agree with.
Yeah, or just a life that we don't understand.
Understand, like, yeah.
I think understanding your privilege is like, I mean, I'm a female and I'm Hispanic, so that kind of puts me a little lower on the totem pole. But I was raised in a family that, you know, I was raised in a pretty affluent family, and
right.
I never had to beg for food, and I never had to wonder, like, if I was going to be able to afford school supplies and stuff like that. It's like, I have privilege. I may not mm-hmm. have as much privilege as, like, you know, a white man whose dad is the CEO of whatever company, you
right,
know?
Right.
But I still come from some level of privilege. And so I just think understanding your privilege and then understanding how your privilege can then be used to help someone mm-hmm. is, like, really, really something that us as Americans need to figure out.
That is so important. I feel like the awareness of privilege, and maybe just because we're getting older, so we're more aware of it, but at least in my life, it's come up in the last, I don't know, 10 years, and I've really realized how much privilege that we do have, and I see so many people that don't understand that they have privilege, and it just kind of makes me want to laugh, but at the same time, I'm like, I think I'm laughing because I'm coping, because it's so ridiculous that you don't think that you have privilege.
Yeah, honestly, I thought this was funny, but Chelsea Handler just came out with a documentary on Netflix, and I think it's called, like, High America, or I think it's called High Privilege, It's Me, Chelsea.
Mm-hmm.
And her documentary is basically about, like, white privilege and, like, how, like, white people do not understand that they have so many more advantages literally just based off of how they look in America than Hispanics or African American or, you know, any minorities.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't even, like, they can't even comprehend that. So her documentary is basically, like, understanding her privilege and also, you know, like, educating people on their privilege. And, I think it's a pretty cool documentary.
I know. Every time I bring up privilege with people who don't, tall, white males in upper-class society, and we're talking about white privilege or just privilege in general, I swear, every time I bring it up, they always bring up, well, what about these colleges now saying, well, there's only a certain amount of percentage that white people can have, or, you know, Latinos have to have a certain amount of a percentage of acceptance rate or whatever, and they're like, how is that privilege? I'm like, you are such a selfish piece of shit.
So, I mean, and then you could just go back and say, well, you know, colleges, in the grand scheme of things, only let in white people for so many years. Also, the race of, like, oh, we want to have, like, some sort of percentage of African-Americans or Hispanics is, one, so they don't get sued, and two, the percentages are, like, 3 or 4% in comparison to, like, the 90% of Caucasians at most schools. So I think you're fine.
Yeah, like, you're going to do fine. Also, your parents went to college and your grandparents had the opportunity to go to college, whether they went or not. And you're comparing yourself to someone who has, we're wondering where their food was going to come from as a kid. When you had everything that you ever needed, you were completely set up for success. And it's like, I think we go back and forth of, like, what's fair? This isn't fair. Like, we sound like fucking five-year-olds. Like, you got that toy. That's not fair. You got 5 minutes with it. I only got 4 minutes with it. Like, that's literally, you can't compare everything. It's not everything is black and white. But we're acknowledging that there's a problem in this country, and we're trying to help it. Whether this helps or not, this is a step in the right direction. If it's going to work, then great. If not, then we're going to have to figure out a different solution. But we're trying something. You don't know until you try.
And I'm definitely very pessimistic about it. And I think that we have so many structures that are so broken. And I think that they will always be broken. And there's always going to be people that don't agree. So, you know, then I'm like, honestly, I can't change probably millions of people's viewpoints, but all that I can do is have my viewpoint and then help the people that I want to help, which is why I love working in, like, the nonprofit sector, because I'm like, oh, I get to work with people that are much more kind than most of the people I would work with if I was in the private sector.
That's so true, though. That is so true. So
and they're probably entitled as well.
Yeah. So with these needle exchanges, has it been shown to decrease HIV and Hep C?
Yeah. Okay. That's how, you know, they were able to get funded and get opened in America, was because, yeah, it shows that, you know, it decreases. Well, one, you're educating about, so, I mean, so many positives come from syringe exchanges. So, first of all, yes, lower rates of HIV, lower rates of Hep C. Secondly, you're giving education about safe sex practices. So, you know, we don't only give out syringes, we also give out condoms, mm-hmm. and dental dams, and, you know,
right. That's awesome.
You know, we teach, a lot of people don't know, but so Hep C is actually more likely to be spread through cocaine use than sexual activity, and that is because it's mainly blood to blood. So you can actually, you're more likely to get Hep C if you're sharing a Coke, like, straw with someone than you are if you're having sex with someone that's Hep C positive.
Interesting.
But so, you know, you're preventing Hep C and then therefore saving the healthcare industry thousands of dollars per person, because they're not seeking, I mean, Hep C treatment is really, really expensive.
Yeah.
It's also, you know, a medication you have to take every day for, I think 6 to 12 weeks, depending on the different, I mean, there are a couple different brands right now, but, you know, it's much more expensive to treat someone's Hep C than it is to just give them syringes so that they don't contract it.
Mm-hmm. So when you say that they're, like, you're offering, like, sex services and other kind of services, do the people that come in for the needle exchange, do they automatically get those services, or is that a separate part of the facility?
Nope, it's right in the syringe exchange. So we do HIV, Hep C, chlamydia, and syphilis testing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's free. And then, you know, we do counseling if anyone tests positive. And, the needle, or the, sorry, the condoms and the lube and everything is just right there. And then, you know, we also teach people, and I know this is probably not, and I think this is where some people get problems, but, you know, we teach people how to safely inject, because if you're injecting the wrong way and you're getting abscesses, and then your abscesses lead to an infection, and then you get endocarditis, which is, you know, endocarditis is mainly, it's an infection of the heart that is mainly
very common in drug users.
To people that inject drugs. So, you know, we are teaching people, you know, how to safely inject. A lot of people don't even know, you know, so definitely put alcohol on your skin before you inject. And people don't understand, like, oh, if I rub my alcohol swab in a circular motion, that is then spreading whatever's on my skin in that same area. So when you're, you know, just simple things like that, like, oh, when you're wiping the alcohol pad, only wipe in one direction.
Right.
You know, where to get your water from when you're injecting. You know, if you, like, I know so much about this from working there, but if all you have is water from the toilet, don't get it from the bowl, get it from, you know, the base of the toilet.
Oh,
because
shit.
That water is cleaner than the toilet bowl water.
Oh, my gosh. Shit that I would never even think about that people are doing.
Right. So, I mean, just basically teaching the safest way, because I think it's just so silly to think, like, oh, people aren't going to inject drugs. Like, we just need to keep having the war on drugs and keep, you know, criminalizing all these people. And it's like, actually, that's just costing us so much money.
Well, and what it sounds like, too, is not only are you, like, doing all these services and stuff, but you're doing it in a way that is non-judgmental and that they can go to people that don't look at them like they are a disgrace to society, that they're disgusting, that they're scared of them. They're going to a place where they're being treated like human beings and really? And with compassion. And I think that could honestly just be the thing that puts these things over the edge of being so beneficial, because they're going to a place that they're comfortable and that they can trust the people there and that they're being treated nicely and with compassion. And that's what we forget. Like we were talking about just saying good morning to someone, like we forget those things. And so having a place where they can go and feel comfortable and like a human, I think is seriously like so important.
No, exactly. They definitely, I mean, exactly. It's a place where they can feel comfortable asking questions about sex and asking questions about drugs. Right. It's like how many people are, you know, think that sex and drugs is so taboo and they don't feel comfortable asking their doctor about, like, how to properly use a dental dam or right. showing their doctor an abscess, you know?
Right.
So, and it's like, yeah, exactly. It's just like the non-judgmental care, you know, like I always tell people because fentanyl is everywhere and, you know, yeah. people are still overdosing from fentanyl and, you know, you can give someone naloxone and let's say you only have one thing of naloxone and they take too much fentanyl and then the one thing of naloxone isn't enough to reverse their overdose. Mm-hmm. So I always tell people, smoke your drugs before you inject it, and that way if they're too strong you will know that, so then you take a smaller shot after you smoke it.
Interesting.
Like just literally just like harm reduction, things like that. There's a book which you can just look it up on Google, and it's called The Guide to Getting Off, and it's basically just like the rule book of like how to safely inject and like not put yourself or your friends at harm when injecting.
Interesting. That's really cool. I think what you're doing is so awesome. So what is the clinic called in Portland, and what's the one in Reno called?
So the clinic I worked at, so the clinic is called Outside In, and then the syringe exchange is called Injection Drug Users Health Services, and it's right around the corner. Okay. And then the one in Reno is Northern Nevada Hope.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they have it. It's like the same. It's a federally qualified health center, and they have an attached syringe exchange.
So they take anyone that's over the age of 18. So anyone that needs any of these services can just go there and get them for free. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep.
It's awesome. And then, do they have doctors and nurses and therapists that work for them as well?
So in the clinic, yes. Not in the syringe exchange, but in the clinic. So what's cool about having an attached medical clinic is that basically you can, like, if someone comes in with a gnarly abscess, you can just refer them. That book, side note.
It's okay.
The book is called Getting Off Right. It's a safety manual for harm, and it was done by the Harm Reduction Coalition.
Cool.
So basically we have an attached medical clinic, so if someone has a really severe abscess or they're super sick or, you know, let's say they have MRSA, they can be seen by a doctor ASAP, which is nice.
Yeah. Well, cool. Do you have anything else to share about the clinic or about your job? Or these people?
I mean, not really. I think I shared it all.
Yeah, I think you did. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast again. I learned so much from you. I think this is a field that I hear about all the time with my kiddos going in and out of drug treatment and therapy, but I don't really know too much about. And so I feel like this information can, one, help me do my job better, but also help anyone else who knows anyone that's addicted to drugs or could possibly be addicted to drugs. I think it helps them trying to figure out where services are and remember to have compassion.
Yeah, totally. I would agree. I think just compassion, being a compassionate, nice person is just like basically a good place to start.
It can be a medicine in itself, which
right.
is cool.
Exactly.
Come on. I see no changes. Wake up in the morning and I ask myself, it's like worth living, should I blast myself? Tired of being poor and even worse, I'm black. My stomach hurts, so I'm looking for a purse to snatch. Cops give a damn about a Negro. Pull a trigger, kill a nigga, he's a hero. Get it back to the kids, who the hell cares? One less hungry mouth on the welfare. First ship them, don't let them deal with brothers. Give them guns, step back, watch them kill each other. It's time to fight back, that's what Huey said. Two shots in the dark, now Huey's dead. I got love for my brothers, but we can never go.
us to share with each other. We gotta start making changes. Learn to see me as a brother instead of two distant strangers. And that's how I'm supposed to be. How can the devil take a brother if he's close to me? I let it go back to what we played as kids, but then change. That's the way it is. Come on. Come on.
That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same.